Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, I'm Michael Steele, and we are in the times of our lives. How much time have you spent with a family member, right? I know everybody's having a lot of fun out there trying to cope in this new environment and, you know, get business going and keep the family together. There's a lot. But as we are in this Easter season, and this Passover season, first off and most importantly, hope everyone is doing well and hope you and your families are having a wonderful holiday. I'm very happy and very pleased to have our guest with us today on the podcast. I have known him and his work for a long time, going back to his days in the Bush administration. And he is one of those public servants that not only has served the nation, but more specifically served his state of Utah. He is none other than former Governor Mike Leavitt, who was three-time governor of Utah and also served in the cabinet of President George W. Bush, first as the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, and then as Secretary of Health and Human Services. And his expertise is going to be very important to hear about today. And he's also the founder and owner of a great little firm called Leavitt Partners, which is a healthcare intelligence business. And I'd be curious to know exactly what that does. So welcome, Governor. Good to have you on the podcast, man.
Michael, it's good to see you again and to have a chance to talk about important stuff. You mentioned about how we are all in our own little isolated world. It's amazing how busy I feel for a guy who's supposedly isolated.
I was telling my assistant, who, God bless Kate, she's a wonderful lady, and she's been trying to coordinate everything. So, you know, before, you know, you have, and you know this, Governor, you go to a meeting and it's out of the office, right? And you know, you got to factor in 20 minutes in a drive or 30 minutes here, you're sitting in traffic. So now all of a sudden, everybody's Zooming it, right? And, you know, meetings are back to back to back. So you've got one at 10, one at 10:45, 11:15. And you're like, wait a minute, time out. I got to get a break here. So, but it's good. It's good. And I'm glad to have you on board. Let me just tap into, first off, so we kind of get a sense of what you're bringing to this conversation. Your time and experience as EPA administrator, on the environmental side of things, but then also specifically what your firm does in this space of healthcare intelligence. What is that, and what do you guys specifically do, and how does it fit into this particular space right now?
Perhaps I can best answer that question by going back to the beginning of at least my own experience with pandemics, because I think my situation was not unlike most Americans in many ways. I went through school and learned basic biology and thought I knew a little bit about viruses and the microbial world. And one day, after roughly 4 months as Secretary of Health, mm-hmm. I was asked to attend a briefing by the head of the Centers for Disease Control, where they began to tell me about a potentially pandemic virus. Mm-hmm. I came to understand in that meeting that a pandemic virus was a virus that had begun to create the capacity genetically to move between, in this case, birds, or in some cases, animals, to people. And when that happens, the science world stands up and becomes alert. And the big problem becomes if it's able to go from a person to another person.
Right.
This virus was called the H5N1 virus. It had not yet made that capacity to go from people to people, but it had made the capacity to go from animals to people. Mm-hmm. And the problem was that 60% of every person who got this virus died. And of course, they were very concerned about that. Well, the next day, a colleague of mine came in to see me, and I think he could tell from my questions that I wasn't fully acquainted with the whole world of pandemics. And
right.
He tossed a book on my desk and said, "You need to learn about this." And then he tossed a second book on the desk, and he said, "Because if you don't, there's going to be one of these, and you're going to be the subject of it." The first book was a history of the great influenza in 1918, where 600,000 Americans died and over 50 million people in the world died.
Wow.
And it was written by a guy named John Barry. It is once again a New York Times bestseller. But he said the other book is a congressional investigation about the government response to the 1976 swine flu. And he said, if you don't get the first one right, if you don't figure this pandemic thing out, there's going to be another one of these, and you're going to be the subject of it. And that got my attention. So over the next nearly 3 months, I studied intensely. I went to CDC. I met with scientists, and I came to realize that these pandemics are a biologic fact. They happen periodically, yeah. And when they do, they change the economy. They change the sociology. They change the politics of the entire world.
Yeah.
So I went to see the president, and I said, "Mr. President, I've got two books for you." Anyway, he read it. To George Bush's credit, he read the John Barry book and said, "We've got to do something to be better prepared." And so we went to Congress and got $7.1 billion. And over the next 3.5 years, I spent a considerable chunk of my time trying to get the country better ready for a pandemic. Event. And so a lot of my life since that day has been involved in how you prepare for this kind of an emergency. Now, in my current role, I'm doing a lot of this right now. Mm-hmm. It wasn't our focus until a couple of months ago. I've been focused very intensely on how to change the healthcare system to be more efficient. We can go into that later. But right now, it's COVID-19 about all the time.
So with that as sort of the backdrop to this conversation, how do you assess the response to this pandemic by this administration? Can you see a nexus of learning between Bush 41 and where we are today? And I particularly love the fact that you talk about and you learn from those books the socioeconomic, political change that occurs as a consequence of it. How would you make that assessment as you, and again, I'm not trying to get partisan and political and all that. I just think people need to understand that there's a body of knowledge out here that you clearly tapped into, shared with the president, who then put in place and effect policy changes. Has that carried forward? What's your assessment of that?
Well, the plan that we developed, the National Pandemic Response Plan, became the foundation of our country's response to pandemics. And we left office in 2009, and within literally months of that time, we ended up with another pandemic potential of influenza, a swine flu that literally took about 1 million lives around the world and was the focus of the Department of Health and Human Services for many, many months. And they used the foundation of that plan that was developed during the Bush administration to deal with that. And it's still the framework of what we're dealing with today. It's been improved. It's been iteratively changed as we've gone along. Mm-hmm. But there's a very well-established footprint, or may I say, game plan for how to respond to this. I think the current administration is following it. Obviously, something different has happened here. This is on a scale we've never seen before. For the first time in our country's history, we have made the bold decision to essentially shut the economy down for a period.
Right.
While none of us know exactly how that will play out. There's a lot of risk involved in doing this either way. And we're now very much in the mode of saying, how do we work our way back out of this once we reach those peaks? So I think the country is responding in a remarkable way, Michael. I don't think we ought to miss the fact that there is a spirit of unity that is spreading across our country right now. And that's very unusual in the sense of where we've been. I mean, imagine Congress in a matter of 2 weeks passing a $2 trillion stimulus program to be able to help the economy recover on a bipartisan basis. Who would have thought about that 3 months ago? Who would have thought that we would respond by closing businesses, closing schools, isolating ourselves for the purpose of fighting a common enemy? This is all not something we would have happen, but we ought not to let this moment pass without realizing Americans are responding to this in a robust way.
How do you balance that though? Because there, you know, you have the president who originally wanted everybody back in church this Sunday, but there were realities there to open up the economy, and that became sort of the clarion call, along with don't let the response be worse than the virus itself. How do you find that balance? Has the administration and all the ancillary parts, from WHO to CDC and hospitals in between, been able to assess that the right way? Because there is a real harsh political, yes, but more importantly, economic impact. You know, we're looking at right now 16 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And the unemployment number is likely to spike close to 10%, if not more. The recovery side, as you know, Governor, on the other side, and you know this, as someone who's had to balance state budgets and, you know, put people to work and keep them to work and all of that stuff, that becomes more and more difficult, doesn't it? In this new environment?
I'll make a couple of observations. The first is, if you study pandemics and viruses over the centuries, one of the things that becomes evident is that anyone who thinks this is a one and done 3 or 4 month proposition and then everything goes back to normal is not facing the reality that pandemics don't behave that way.
Right. They have a mind of their own.
We're dealing with a longer-term situation, a new risk that we're having to learn to manage, and that we'll be dealing with this over the course of the next probably 2 or 3 years. Now, we can't allow our economy to lie in stasis for much longer.
Right, exactly.
And so we're going to have to now begin to stage a recovery by being able to create different levels of recovery as they are warranted, and they won't happen uniformly the same place. We'll begin to see hotspots in places other than New York, for example.
Mm-hmm. We're starting to see it here in Maryland, right?
It won't be the same in New York City as it might be in Kansas or in North Dakota.
Right.
So we've got to create a mechanism where people can respond according to the more local situation and move the economy back as rapidly as possible. And then we're all going to have to learn a new set of skills and adapt to a kind of new normal for a while.
And it is the new set of skills that it's going to be fascinating. I agree, because when you look at, you know, wholesale industries that have imploded in some respects, particularly in the hospitality space, how quickly they recover, how quickly they're able to bring people back. I appreciate very much in STEM 3 this notion that, okay, we're going to give you, small business owner, a loan, which will convert to a grant if you, A, don't fire your employees, or B, you hire them back and you keep them on payroll for a period, I think is specified, like 2 months or something like that. That is all very, very helpful. But then I go to your point on the other side of that. What are going to be the new skills required to re-anchor the economy and then build and grow off of that? Because, as you know, Wall Street taketh a lot quicker than it giveth. So the hits that we've had in our 401ks and the market drops that we've seen are not going to come back like that as fast as they went down. You're not going to get back 10,000 points in the Dow by December. So the reality begins to set in pretty quickly, I think, for a lot of business owners and certainly for a lot of families out there. And that's where I think the governors have played an important part in sort of creating operational spaces, not just on the COVID side of trying to get the resources they need, but then I know in talking with Governor Hogan here in Maryland, once this begins to get over the hump and we're now into a plateau of sorts, how do we start to put people back to work? And what does that look like?
So let me lay out the way I think this begins to shift. We will see in some form a status system where we have red, orange, yellow, green.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
Just like we do with 9/11, terrorism.
Yeah, right.
And in some ways it will reflect other conditions that we have seen. For example, I live in the West, but I fly east a lot. And mm-hmm. so if I'm going to New York or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C., it's not uncommon for me to look at the weather and see that there's a winter storm warning that right. just shuts that city down.
Right, right.
No one goes into the city. Right. People work from home. They close the schools. It lasts about 3 or 4 days. We may now see a new category where it would be a COVID-19 hotspot warning where for a period of time where there's a resurgence, a second or a third wave, which there always is in these pandemics, that we could need to move from status to status. So if we were in yellow and it became orange again, we might have to implement intermittent social distancing for a period in certain geographic areas. That will mean businesses will have to learn to adapt. For example, if you are in red, it probably means no one's going to a restaurant. If you're going to orange, it may mean that we're able to have food either delivered or picked up. Mm-hmm. If you go to yellow, it may be a little more social spacing or social distancing.
Right, you just limit the number of tables you're sitting.
But you can go in. If you go to green, things go back to normal. On meetings, if you're in red, you may say, we just don't have meetings. We do everything online mm-hmm. To the extent that we can. If you go to orange, it may be that you can have small meetings with immediate family and people that you know. If you go to yellow, then you would say you could have meetings of 10 to 15. If you go to green, it can be much larger events. That's the kind of phasing. And I think that we will see that there will be times when parts of the country are green. There'll be parts when during the same period, you may have some that are yellow and some that are that are orange.
Right.
But we'll all have to develop means of operating to manage this new risk as we go forward.
That's some of the smartest forward thinking I've heard in this process, because no one is talking the way you've just talked about this. And I think that's important, because I'm all about the moment that we're in and trying to solve that problem. But there's got to be someone in the room that goes, okay, so when this is all done, then what do we do?
And that, well, you ask about what I do, and that's right now we're advising states. And I think you'll see in the next few days, states beginning to introduce, and perhaps even through the national government, a system that looks like I described. And right. that's the kind of thing that I've been spending my time thinking
well,
about.
Well, I love it. I love it. It's smart. And I'm glad my listeners got a chance to peek into your thinking on that, because it really does set the stage for the future. We're going to take a quick break, Governor. When we come back, we're going to have more of this great conversation with the one and only Mike Leavitt. We'll be right back after this.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
All right, everybody, we're back. And we're talking with former governor of Utah three times. I put up two fingers, three times. Yeah, so this is that kind of environment. Three times this man got elected by the good people of his state. And he served in Bush 43, George W. Bush's cabinet. as the first administrator of the EPA, and then as Secretary of Health and Human Services. So amid the ongoing environment that we're in, the concerns that people have, what's your view on the upcoming election and how vote by mail or absentee ballots can play a role in helping people stay safe and continue to participate in the franchise of exercising their vote?
A very interesting independent study was recently made of the state I live in, which is the state of Utah, where they have shifted to all, where every county has the ability to do vote by mail. Mm-hmm. And they were able to compare it to previous elections. And there is essentially no question, based on this study, that you get somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 7% greater participation in a vote by mail election.
Mm-hmm.
That is a profoundly important development in my view, because we're seeing voter participation fall in America, and that's a bad thing.
Right.
So I think we're going to see more movement toward vote by mail simply because of the move toward greater participation. Now, having said that, obviously that has political ramifications, and it could have a profound impact on who votes and how they and that'll play out, I suspect, in every state, and different parties will have a different view on this. But I want to again make the point that there's never been a pandemic in human history that's been recorded that didn't profoundly affect the outcome of the way governments are structured and the way power structures work. Mm. And that's not just in one country, it's across the world. There are almost always leaders who succumb.
Yeah.
And that creates a change. There are times when people become discontent because of the managing of it.
Right.
And that begins to become an issue.
And I think to that point, you're starting to see that erosion occur in the polling, the national polling, at least with respect to President Trump, where a couple of weeks ago he was at 50%, 50 to 55%, depending on the poll you were looking at, of people supporting his initiative. Now, certainly in a number of the key battleground states that are going to be important, Pennsylvania, Florida, et cetera, that number is dipped below 50% again. And so there is that space where the electorate is behind you because, okay, you're the commander in chief, you got things, you're rolling, we trust you. And then they kind of see the results over time and they go, wait a minute, you're not doing enough, or it's not sufficient here. And that begins to eat at their confidence in the system. And what I found, and what I have found in watching the daily press briefings, is almost a bifurcation of that event. You've got the sort of the showman part in the beginning with the president coming out and doing what he does. And then on the back end, you've got, you know, Vice President Pence, who is a sober guy to begin with in so many ways, on so many levels. But then it's this real sobering kind of, you know, presentation that even the tone of Dr. Burtz and Fauci changes in that. And I think the public, by and large, walks away from the folks that I've talked to, at least in my neighborhood, when I do get into the grocery store and we're standing 6 feet apart, it creates a little bit of confusion and concern. You have been in the crucible as a governor and as a secretary in a cabinet at a time where we were in a post 9/11 world, and where those sensibilities are heightened. How do you, as a public official, assess the communication to the public, and how valuable that is in allaying fears and concerns, or urging them to move and act in a certain way?
Well, I'll make 3 points here. The first one is that anyone who is leading during a pandemic has a dilemma. And the dilemma is that anything you say in advance sounds alarmist.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah.
Anything that you have done after it starts is inadequate.
Fair, fair. Yeah.
And that is just a fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
The second point I would make is that if you look back on the history of other pandemics and historians who have evaluated them, what becomes clear is that the most important thing in communicating is to tell people the truth. Confusion is not their friend.
Right.
They can and they will adapt if they have the truth and a steady supply of it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have valued greatly somebody like Tony Fauci.
Yeah.
Because I think people believe he is telling exactly what he believes, and he's become this steady voice in a storm. Mm-hmm. And we have looked for that. How? So I would say the third thing is that it's going to be enormously important that the American people have a sense of confidence, not just in the information, but an optimism about the fact that we can, in fact, and will, in fact, come through this, and that we are beginning to see some good news. And that's true. We're starting to see states mm-hmm. who are saying, we're not seeing what we worried we would see with the models. And therefore, there may be some things that we can change that will allow us to go back to work at some point. And this is the schedule.
Speaking of the models, though, I was struck by something that Dr. Burt said yesterday or the day before about, you know, they model the models. How does that process work? Are we too model heavy? Because models, in my political experience, don't necessarily relate to what's really happening on the ground because of either lag times or insufficient flow of information or presumptions in many cases or assumptions that are made that sort of tailor the model to a certain outcome.
I learned very early in my public policy experience that models populate your thinking. They are not a substitute for your judgment.
Ah, wise and, words.
And that, every model is based on assumptions. And every assumption is based on, again, someone's guess. Mm-hmm. Because if you had perfect information, if you had perfect insight, you'd have less variability. But models are useful. We have to have them to plan. It's the best information we have. But we have to begin, we have to deal with what's actually happening on the ground. And I think it's very possible that we have honestly and directly built the best models we have. And it's possible in some cases it will underestimate the impact. And in many cases, it may overestimate the impact. And we need to be in a position where we have a system like I described, where we're able to move from status to status based on the actual information we have.
Right, right. I, before I let you go, I want to bring this full circle and sort of key in on your work in this healthcare space. There's no doubt that we've exposed our healthcare system in a way that I think we've kind of glossed over and sort of turned an eye to, you know, away from and pretend it didn't exist, as we see the disproportionate impact this virus is having on the Black community, for example. And now all of a sudden, now everybody's talking about healthcare disparities like it's something new. It's like, duh, it's been a part of the problem going back to the 1960s, for God's sake. And all of a sudden now, you know, you having this sort of contextualized conversation around what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were proposing with a Medicare for all type healthcare system. You've governed in this space and had to make those decisions to ensure that the people of Utah had not just adequate, but affordable and accessible healthcare. How does this pandemic change our thinking about our healthcare system? And what measures do you think should begin to be put in place for an overall, I guess a relook, if you will, at our healthcare system in the future?
It's going to supercharge the discussion because, as you point out, all the flaws are going to be magnified and a very bright light shined on them. And it's going to highlight a collision of priorities that we have and feel. We're a compassionate country. We want people to have health care. It's the reason we have Medicare. It's the reason we have Medicaid. It's the reason employers provide insurance. And yet we also want to have economic leadership. And to the degree that we continue to spend 25% or rather 20 or more percent of our entire economy on health care, it puts us at an economic disadvantage. So this collision between how we deal with health care, what priority we give it, is going to become a not just a health care issue, it's going to become an economic issue. How do we remain competitive and still provide people? I think this conversation is going to enliven the discussion as to whether the role that government will play in our lives. And I think there's going to be a lot of pressure when this is all over to begin to see government's role increase. And unless the other side of that argument can put forward some very compelling arguments, I think we could see quite substantial change in the way the healthcare system operates in the next 5 years.
Wise words from the governor and the secretary, Mike Leavitt. It is such a treat to have you on today, man. I really appreciate your insights. You dropped some knowledge here, particularly in this space around the hotspot warning system. We'll definitely will be looking out for that and watching your leadership on that as you help the states kind of deal with this state by state, day by day, week by week. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you, Michael. All great right. to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you as well. That does it for this episode, folks. Don't forget to download us at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. It's always great to have great gentlemen like the Secretary, Governor Leavitt on with us. Listen, download, have fun. Stay safe. Stay safe, most importantly. We'll catch y'all next time. Thank you.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.